Let's get everybody settled in and go ahead and get this kicked off. We definitely have a lot of material to cover, so I am going to go ahead and start a timer so I don't run over. Shout out to our sponsors, of course. Without them, this wouldn't be possible. And if you are not aware, we have a conference app, a mobile app for you to download that has all the sessions and everything. If you have already downloaded this app, then you are fully qualified to be at this talk because we built another one. Different, but just like it. The one that we built is actually inspired by the 2016 Xamarin Evolve app that James Montemagno had put together. So we sort of refreshed that and gave it some new features like the Xamarin Form Shell and a lot that we're going to cover in just a moment. A little bit about myself. I am Paul Schroeder. Would love it if I got some follows on Twitter, at Paul B. Schroeder. I run a small consulting shop in Chicagoland, MSC Technology Consulting. We do specialize in Xamarin. Can anyone tell me, this is kind of an interesting thing, can anyone tell me what this is down here or what this screenshot is from? Yes, exactly. It's a 1979 Atari game, and what this represents is William Robinette worked in an era when they didn't allow developers to put their name in the credits or anything like that. So what he did is he made one of the first, probably the first Easter egg in a game. That was popularized here in this movie, Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg's adaptation of the book. The reason this kind of ties into the talk is because just like when William Robinette was working, a lot of the work was treated like factory output, basically. It wasn't, developers weren't treated as artistic or creative and whatnot. And what we're going to try to do in this talk, besides provide you a full like enterprise app as an example, is to kind of get the idea that if we co-generate a lot of the material, that we allow our developers to focus less on the infrastructure, less on the boring, tedious, repetitive code, and more on the things where they can add value. We're talking about the user interface. We're talking about business rules. We're talking about integrating with other systems. This is usually where I'm at about 2 p.m. right now, is feeling a little sleepy like this guy. But like I said, we've got tons to cover, so there's not going to be any sleeping in this presentation. Here's what we're going to look at in a moment. I'm going to play a video for you, but it's going to move really quick. I will demo a little bit, but because of the time constraints, I'm trying to rely on videos to keep it quick and the context switching. And so this app implements the Xamarin Form Shell, Azure Blob Storage, JWT Security, SQLite. This is all out on GitHub. It's in the repo for Xamarin Dev Summit. You're all welcome to check it out. The video is going to show us logging in. That's where the JWT tokens come in. A really cool feature is the use of sample data or swapping that out with live API data. Again, this is a conference app with user profiles, so there's the ability to swap out pictures for those, right? And you can either take a picture with the camera or choose one from your local storage. In the end, there's code in there to put it up in Azure Blob Storage, and we'll walk through a lot of this. You can also like sessions, right? With that said, let's go ahead and play a video now that you kind of got a primer for what you're about to see. So here we're taking a look at the speakers. Once we've done that, we're going to take a look at some sessions by time. We're going to scroll down and we're going to like one of these sessions. Once we like it, we'll move to a different view, which is our favorites view. Right. Once we move into the favorites view, we'll see that one actually shows up. And we'll go back out and take a look at the profile. And then we'll click the little edit button to edit the profile. And that's me a couple hours ago changing the picture. This is a very dynamic, very current material here. Yeah, good one. So what are we doing here? Now we're switching it back. So now we're showing choosing a picture from the local file storage, basically. All right. This is the database schema. It's modest. It's up here we've got kind of some ASP.NET identity tables, blob files that we're using to store information about what we're putting up in Azure, and you can read some of the rest of these. It's just basic information to track conference-related data. Normally, this session would take like more like 2 hours to explain enterprise architecture, why we do all this stuff. In the end, let's just keep in mind that people are always asking us developers to do have a lot of scope, a lot of features, very little cost, and very little time, right? In the end, if we compress that too much, quality suffers. The idea is that by using code generation, we're trying to actually achieve this. We're trying to break out of that project triangle or that iron triangle where we can do things super quick. There would normally be a lot more information about what the problems are that we're going to face. A couple I'll touch on here is this idea of demoware. I've been on projects where it's constantly like, we need to demo these features next month, these features in 3 weeks, and we're not getting time to go back and build the infrastructure. Software requirements, we're always going to have changes to software requirements. You know, Agile's supposed to welcome it. We're always going to have misses. We're always going to have things that we didn't think about. Ambiguity. When ambiguity happens, developers are faced with a couple choices. They can either make an assumption and move on, which generally can work, turn out to be rework, right, if they make the wrong assumption, or they have to go seek clarification. And when they do go seek that clarification, sometimes it's not always timely, the responses that get back. So the idea is, this is kind of demoware, right? And so the point of this talk is, if we co-generate a lot of this stuff that's boilerplate, that's repetitive, we have more time to spend building out. You know, a lot of this is already built out for us, but then we have more time to focus on, like I said, the business rules. And this quote here just seems to come up every now and then for me, where we're always pressured. There's not time to do it right, but you end up doing the whole thing over again. I do want to mention that when I'm talking about demoware, I'm not talking about the feedback loop. The feedback loop's important. What I'm talking about is that when you're constantly pressured to do demos and you don't get time to build out the features, you do need a feedback loop, which every few weeks you're demonstrating it to stakeholders, getting that feedback, making sure you're not getting too far off the rails. This slide kind of, in a nutshell, summarizes this talk. The idea is that we're going to use proven patterns, things that follow these solid principles. Once we have those patterns in place, we're going to use those to craft a reusable architecture, one that's sort of generic. We're talking about enterprise line of business applications, big databases, things where you've got to synchronize data from the server to your client app. And we'll show a little bit of that in just a bit. The next step is componentize, and we'll talk about that later. It essentially means making some NuGet packages out of your common foundational features and functions. Once we have all of that in place, those first three steps, the next level of our hierarchy is to co-generate things that then work with our NuGet packages. The idea is that we're reducing the time it takes, which allows us to address other technology risks we might have earlier in the project, get something out faster, which allows us to adapt to market needs. This idea of turnover, if you've ever been on a project that runs for a long time, you know that what ends up happening is you'll start to lose a team member or two, some key players over time. So if it goes 6 months or a year, sometimes people are only staying at companies a year or two these days. And so by getting something out there faster, you are reducing the impact that has on your project. Quality. Sometimes I don't like to think about this, but I do like to think about it in that when you're co-generating it, there's no flaws in the code. There's no errors. If there is an error, you fix it in your template, you regenerate, and now it's gone in your code base. And then the next project will certainly not have that same bug. This slide is also very important, so we're going to spend a moment talking about this. When we're talking about enterprise architecture, and we're talking about all these layers, and we're following solid principles, et cetera, by the way, I see a lot of you taking pictures, and that's totally cool. Go for it. But all these slides are available in the repo as well. So we're starting with the SQL Server database, right? Entity framework, pulling things out. We map that into what are called data transfer objects. This is on the server side. The colors aren't super easy to see, but this is representing server side stuff. And then this like kind of light blue is client side stuff, our Xamarin apps. So we take our data transfer objects. We're sending them from a web API into the client data loader service. And from there, we're converting our data transfer objects, again through mappers, into model data and storing it in the SQLite database that's on the client. Doesn't have to be SQLite. It could be like Couchbase or whatever you want to use. But point is, it's persisted on the client app. Now, a user is going to start using that app, right? So once they start using the app, now those model datas that come out of the SQLite database are getting mapped into something called model objects. Those model objects are perhaps implementing your iNotify property change, your observable objects. There's different concerns there, right? So that's why we have all these classes, which is a lot of code to write. Then we're going to use those in our view models, and obviously the view is going to be using those observable objects. So I'm going to click the button in a moment, and what's going to drop out is the part of this architecture, is the part of these layers that we code generate, or that can be code generated. After we code generate, this is what's left for the developer to focus on. Again, something I should qualify that with. This is not, code generation is not a silver bullet. It will get you your CRUD operations. It will get you your bootstrapping. It will get you up and running quickly, right? You're always going to have to write some custom code. The idea is that if you architect it right, you follow that O in the SOLID principles for open for extensibility, and then you can write that custom code that you need. So we're left with that data load service. That's a pretty easy one to write, so we just haven't done much with the code generation there. Your view models and your views, technically you could generate basic views and view models, but we don't. And you're focusing on your business logic and over time moving more stuff into domain classes that you're handcrafting if you want to follow more of a domain-driven design. Okay, why do we do all that? There's a reason why we do all these layers and all this extra code. Obviously, we've invested some time that it's easier to do it and generate it, so that overhead that you'd normally have of writing all these classes isn't there. But if you notice, even with our current app, which is perfectly fine for a couple-day summit, works well, but it doesn't function offline. When you're storing it in the SQLite database and pulling it out client-side, it's just doing a check. You'll see checks in the sample code that says, do I have a network connection? And if I do, I might go and refresh my data, but otherwise the whole thing's working off of the local data store. So I don't need that network connection. So the idea is that the offline capability is baked in. Oh, what did I just do? There we go. Single responsibility principle, let's not spend too much time on this, but the idea is that these classes have different functions. One is being used to store data in SQLite, one is being used for MVVM Lite, right? In this case, we've got to define what our tables are, and in this case, we are doing some iNotify property change stuff. Let's take a look. Let's dive into a little bit of code and see what some of these look like. Amarin, here's some mapper code. So this would be examples down here of, say, the MVVM Lite classes. I hope that's big enough that everyone can see it. There's nothing crazy in this class, right? It's pretty standard. Again, that boilerplate code that's following a very predictable pattern for each property. We can handwrite these, right? That's only, for this, less than 200 lines of code. But for every table in our database now, right? And then we have the model data classes that are for SQLite. If we look at, what are we on, session? Let's look at session over there. It's kind of the same thing, even a smaller file, but now we're looking at attributes that tell SQLite what to do with this class. And then we have our mapper code, and our mapper code is converting things. Let's see here. We're converting things between the model object and the data transfer objects. We're converting things between the SQLite classes and data transfer objects. We're converting things between data transfer objects and the model objects. And that code, again, is very clear, very boilerplate. I will say, on the server side, what we do is we use like auto mapper, so there's not so many lines. On the client side, we're just doing this kind of by hand. Well, when I say by hand, it's auto-generated. All these classes end up, you'll see this. Any class that has this at the top, we didn't write by hand. And that's why, you know, we can end up doing it this way, this like 1,700 lines of code that we didn't actually have to write. It's generated in seconds. Let's keep going here. So the idea that I've already touched on is it's only 22 classes for this very modest database, but we've had clients with, you know, 140 tables per database, and they want to do three different databases in one app sort of thing. So that times four, plus all the mapping code, now you're talking about 88 classes I didn't have to write, 90 if you count these, and all that lines of code. Everybody with me still? Cool. All right, basics of code generation. If you haven't had much, you probably have touched it, even if you're not even sure what it is in one way or another. But the idea is that you create some templates that have expected or known input parameters. Then you're getting some metadata about from a source. And your source could be a database, DB schema, or it could be like an API specification. And you're pulling that out, and you're going to run your templates against that metadata, which generally generates some output classes that you'll incorporate into your solution. If you've ever used, like, back in the MVC time, you'd like have a model and it'd say generate the views off this model. That's code generation. That's using T4 templates. There's definitely more ways than one to skin a cat, or for those of you that don't like that, there's several ways to do something. I don't know where they come up with this more ways than one than skin a cat. In our case, you know, over time, we just rolled our own. Sample data, data loader. This is a cool feature of the application. We talked about the idea that we can swap out our sample data here using this iData loader interface. So in this case, we've auto-generated just some sample data. Once it's generated, you can go in and change titles and stuff if you wanted to, right? But all the stuff's already built out. And then in this case, it's really just whether I want to use sample data or use live data switch in the app, and then it starts loading it from our web API. And by the way, if you want to know more about that, Robin Schroeder, who had a huge hand in writing the Xamarin portion of the app here, is speaking tomorrow at 3 o'clock. A bunch of tips on delivering things quickly and on time and on budget. Client code to access the web API. The idea is we've generated the web API, so we know what that looks like. That means we can also generate the client-side code to access that web API. And it's abstracting away the complexity from our Xamarin developer of the intricacies of calling that web API. They could still get down to the bare bones and do it, but what we've done over here is provide simple methods for them to call and pass in something like a minimum modified date or whether they want deleted records or not or how they want the data sorted to come back. And this is responsible for then calling the web API. And we'll see some examples of that. The idea is that out of the box, you're generating, getting all the data, getting just a page of the data, getting something like one individual object by primary key, create, update, and delete. So, can anyone tell me why we might pass something like the minimum modified date to the web API? If we're calling from a client-side application into the server side and we're trying to get that data and load it to the client? Yes. Minimize the amount of data and you're getting the changes. So maybe the first time the app loads, you're getting whatever data is relevant for that user. Now tomorrow when the user fires up that app, I don't need to load all of those records, I just need to know what changed, right? So that's where these things like the minimum modified date and is deleted comes in. So that's useful for data synchronization. The number of child levels, that comes into play where, like, say I'm getting one entity, and maybe I'm getting a information about a session. Well, I might want to pull the speaker information at the same time instead of making two calls from the web API. So this parameter tells the API how many levels I want, basically. And then there's ways, technically, to customize exactly what comes back based upon that value. We're going to dig into this filter criterion first. You know what? There is one thing that I didn't do, and that was kind of, we're going to take a chance on a live demo here. We'll see how quickly we can do this. I'm going to log in to the app. Looks like we're good there. And I'm going to go into my profile. And David Ort now does not look like that. So we're going to take a new picture. If you could indulge me for a second. I don't know how well this will turn out. Oh, I got to switch this over. There we go. Smile. Okay, good enough. Let's mark that as good. It changes out, now watch, it's gonna change in just a moment. See how it got kind of wonky there? There's also some resizing code built in to the backend web API. So when it uploaded it to Azure, it also ran some resizing code, which does not have a very good aspect ratio maintenance algorithm in it, but it kind of proves the point, right? All right. So now if we go over to our Azure Storage Explorer, just to show you that this actually worked, and I apologize, I'm kind of bouncing back a little bit here. We're going into our images. I'm going to sort by last modified. We see 223. Let's see if we can download that. And you see we've got this thumbnails folder. And let me sort by last modified again. 223, just after it. Save those to my downloads. Oh, did I get the right? I'm in thumbnails.
It's the same
day as the image. No, I hear what you're saying. I'm kind of wondering, I don't think that should have happened. That's okay, that's fun of live demos. Let's see what these actually are. Let's go out to the downloads. All right. This probably came out as a JPG, which is actually contained in the blob file table. There's information about what the media type of these are, content types. That's probably a PNG. Okay, so now we see there's this one, and we see there's this one that came, and again, the aspect ratio not maintained. If we take a look at their file sizes, you see one say 316K and one 65K, right? But again, so that's just kind of demonstrating that we actually uploaded things into Azure live from our demo. Moving back over here, the client web API code, we can take a look at some of that. Even though we've got some extracts, let's maybe see what we've got there. So we're looking at iWeb API data service. Let's see where that's at. Right here. So here we talked about the idea of getting all pages, getting page data, getting by primary key, creating, updating, deleting, right? This is an interface, and even with an interface, it's 350 lines of code that I didn't have to write. All right, and if we take a look at the implementation of that, how does all these things work? That's some custom methods. Let's see here. So get by primary key. Here you go. Get user profile async. We will look at what this filter criteria is. All we're doing when we're calling the web API from the Xamarin side is creating this thing that's called filter criterion, passing. These are all auto-generated. Technically, this should be more like an enumeration. But since it's generated, it hasn't really mattered. We're saying we want the modified date with a date that's a date time, and we want it to be greater than whatever date we passed into the parameter. Remember, we're passing that in. The idea is that this follows a very concise pattern. It's very easy to read for a developer. So imagine they can just copy one of these methods, paste it into a custom area here, and reuse it. And they can pick another field on the table that they want to filter on. Whether it's a speaker's name or, I don't know, what else, a room name or something like that for a search criteria. The API is very flexible in that way. And I don't know if we'll have time to demonstrate it, but the idea is that when you're calling the web API, you're passing these criteria, it's dynamically interpreting them. Not only that, but you can pass a fields parameter and it will just data shape the object that's coming back. Say you're populating a drop-down list from a table. You don't need every record and every column in that table, right? You don't need every column. You need like the name, maybe the ID. So that's what it'll do. It'll just data shape that and only return what you need. There's a super cool concept when we built it a couple years ago and we've been using it since then. Just for your information, if that idea interests you, Brandon Minnick's doing a demonstration of GraphQL, tomorrow at about 2 p.m. And he's going to demonstrate Microsoft's way that they're going to be doing this. Let's see here. We've kind of talked about this, the idea that we didn't have to write all this code. Moving on. It's OData-ish. This isn't OData, it's OData-ish, because you kind of get to craft the queries you want on the client side, send them up to the web API. The web API interprets it, sends down just what you asked for. Am I moving too quick? Is everybody still with me? Okay, cool. We talked about this being the O in the open, where we're uploading images to the server. We're downloading images from the server. Thank you. These are using the same interface that was code-generated. So in other words, we're extending that interface. And we're doing that through partial classes, right? So if you can make some partial classes, now if I change something in the database, I update my schema, I regenerate, I'm not overwriting that custom code that I wrote to upload and download images. We are here. This is where we're at in the talk. We've kind of gone over some of the solid patterns. We've shown that we have a reusable architecture, the basis for a generic-ish architecture, right? And next, we're going to talk about componentizing the architecture. And we're going to talk about, we've kind of shown how we code-generate some of these sections. Up next, we'll have the NuGet components that we're talking about. We've already seen a lot about Azure Blob Storage, so I won't spend a lot of time. The code is in the repository. Dependency injection, what that allows us to do. And then we're going to talk about how we keep credentials private. That's an important aspect. JWT, Web API. We're not going to do anything with CodeGen Hero today. We maybe will show a demo during the Q&A session. Open source components. What am I talking about when I'm talking about componentizing the architecture? Basically taking out those fundamental pieces, those foundational pieces that apply to each solution, wrapping them up in their own libraries, making NuGet packages out of them. It's surprisingly easy to do. Some teams that we've worked with have their own NuGet servers in their corporate environments, and they make their own libraries, and they reference them in multiple solutions. That's all we've done with this code, which is out here on GitHub, MIT license, and then that's just been packaged in NuGet, which you'll notice in the sample code base, it just references the NuGet packages in the solution. That's where they're coming from. Azure Blob Storage. Let's take a look at how we configure uploading and downloading images to Azure Blob Storage. That would be on the server side, right, where we're going to put this information. So FYI, I have two solutions open, two Visual Studios open. One is the server-side API, and one is the Xamarin client, right? So web API config. We're using Dry IOC as a container. Right, for our inversion of control. And here we're calling register our dependencies. This would be a service for us. And so now we see we're configuring this thing called, it's an interface for Azure Storage. And we're just doing this out of our configuration file. Excuse me. So now we have this account key, right? This is kind of sensitive information. We really shouldn't be storing that in our config files. We shouldn't be checking that into source control. Same with our connection strings. If we actually take a look at the web config for this, I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but it'll save us time later. We'll see that we have something called a configuration builder. This configuration builder section has an item in it called simple JSON. I'm referencing that simple JSON in my connection strings. I'm referencing that simple JSON in my app settings. And if you'll notice, when I configure it, I'm referencing a JSON file over here, this developer config JSON. Surprise, it's JSON. And it looks like this. You know what? It's actually in a later slide. Looks like this. Not too hard. Here's my app settings section. Here's that account key. And you know, it's truncated there. And here's my audience secret. And here's my connection string. I'm not checking this file into source control. Yes, sir. .NET Core has its own thing. Yep. Same functionality. This is more for like the full framework implementation. You can do the exact same thing. That's a good point. Another thing that you can do besides this is when you go to deploy your information, you know, 5 years ago, you're always doing these config transforms, and you're having a production file, and you're putting your connection strings in the prod file, and when you deploy, it works very nicely. But that also required you to put your connection string in source control, where other developers who maybe you don't want to have access to production get at it. So what you can do is when you deploy, say, using an app service, you've got these settings, configuration, and that's where I'm configuring things like the account key, and there's another section for your connection strings. So just know that that's available. We are getting close to the end. How are we doing on time here? Let me double check. We are doing really well on time, I think. Yeah, about 14 minutes left. Okay, JWT security. I'm not gonna be able to dive deep into this. We simply don't have enough time. But I will give you a reference to a blog post where a lot of the code that you see in the sample solution is based on. And these are the three files in particular that you'd want to look at. And we already mentioned we're kind of using these identity-based tables. Simple to follow and use. We can take a look at an authorize attribute in the code. And we can look at some custom code that is written to authenticate our user. Let's just look at that code, and then we'll get into Postman, and it'll be a little more coherent. All right, so on the server side, we want to do authorize stuff. So we have all these web controllers. We talked about we generate all this code, right? What does that code look like? Here's sessions. We've looked at sessions before. And what we'll notice is there's a base class with an authorized attribute. Authorized name at the end of it. Here's our route prefix, and then you'll see this authorize attribute. And the way we've configured it, that's what's inspecting that JWT that's coming in. That's what's telling it whether it's authorized or not. What else can I tell you? Obviously, you want to put your custom, your logic that applies across several controllers in here. Let's see if we've got, this is sessions controller. Let's look at our custom controller here. From a security standpoint, you see this iSession object that we're injecting here? This one's kind of cool. If you look at the configuration, the way it's set up, when we register those dependencies, every time we get an HTTP response message, we're creating this thing iSession when the controller asks for it and passing it in. What is in this thing? This thing basically is just some convenience methods. You can put whatever you want in here. But in this case, I put a couple convenience methods to say, is the current user a conference organizer? Because we're going to have a business rule that says the current user, if their user profile ID matches the user profile ID of the image that you're trying to change, that's the same user, then I'm trying to change my own profile photo. That's allowed. If I'm trying to change someone else's profile photo, I need to be a conference organizer. So let's take a look at maybe where this code's being used. So we see here, very easily, I just injected this session thing. I didn't have to write anything. It's just available for me to use. So we're checking, is it the current user or is it a conference organizer? And I'll show you in just a moment when we jump over to Postman, the JWT, the JSON web token, what that looks like. I'm trying to think, is there anything else I need to talk about here? The controllers implement something called HATE OAS. It basically talks about like when you're getting data back, what is the link to the page of data in front of you? What is the link to the page behind you? How many records are in this result? How many are there total? What page are you on? Stuff like that, all baked in. Okay, Postman tests. This is kind of a cool thing. Quick show of hands, do people use Postman? You guys testing API? Oh yeah, okay. Well, I might be telling you something you already know then. We'll just run through it. I didn't always know until probably a couple years ago that you could do this. But so I'm running my API, and the idea is that I have tests behind each one of these. So I always put in a status check. In our Xamarin apps, we'll build in a heartbeat check too. So not only am I online, but is the API available? So I could do a heartbeat before I go synchronizing data. The heartbeat is not meant to be authorized, right? Anybody can check the heartbeat. And then here what we're showing, I should pause here. Good. We got an access token back, and then what I'm showing in here is what the tests are doing. In this case, for this particular function of getting a token, I'm just expecting the lengths to be greater than zero, right? I'm also, storing things in global variables. I'm using those global variables in other places, in other items. You can see that I've got things to get a refresh token, things to set the profile image, to get all the users, to get a current user, get all the feedback. If you haven't used Postman tests like this before, definitely check it out. There's a folder in the repo that has the Postman tests and the environment variables. All you have to do is import it into Postman. And let's take a look at the second one here. So not only can I run these one at a time, which I will show you now. Let's see here. So I can check the status, right? And it comes back just fine. And we see we've got this token, and I can send it again, and you know the data changes a little bit. But what we're kind of interested in here is this idea that I sent in some information. Let's see if we got that. I sent in this username and this password, right? And I'm getting back information that corresponds to that user because it was a successful authentication. Something else we could show is that if we actually changed the token here, let's see here, authorization. So right now I've got this token that I'm passing. Remember I set this as a global variable. So let me take that out. Just pass something random. And I get back authorization denied, right? Let me put that variable back in. And now it's happy to give me the data that I asked for. So, a 503, it should have been a 403. Let me check. Authorization denied. It is a 401 unauthorized. This, not this.
When you type CCC.
This guy? Oh, when I type CCC? Okay, let's try that. Is that what you're talking about? 401?
The size.
Oh, the size? Oh, that's okay. If we have flaws, we want to fix them, right? I'm going to find them and fix them. Okay, last cool thing. Let's do collection runner. If you know a lot about Postman, you probably know about the collection runner, but I just love this aspect. If you've done unit tests before, it's very similar to unit tests, except this time we're hitting our API with all these tests at once. So you deploy your stuff. Once you've deployed it, is it actually working? So what I like to do is, I'll create some data, and then I record the identities of that data that I've created, and I go back and clean it up, right? And that really quickly, you know, we just run 26 tests, and we can see like things are pretty good. Let's see here. Thank you very much. So this is the portion. We've got 6 minutes left where we'll open it up for a Q&A, obviously. We've got some stickers available on the back. If anybody, this wasn't really a demo about CodeGen Hero, but if you're interested in it and you want a personal demo, just grab Robin or I, and we'll be happy to do that. With that, I'd like to clearly, if you like what you saw, follow me. If you really like what you saw and you want us to help you with some work, obviously we're a consulting company, contact us. We'd be happy to help. And let me just end as we do our question and answer. I'll just play a video. This one's pretty dated, but this is a Bingo Buzz application that we wrote. And that was the rules to it. We're going to open it up. Here's the table schemas that we're extracting the metadata from. Here's how we configure things. It's a Visual Studio extension, right? It looks quite a bit different now. And it generates all those class files, right? And we're saying basically, I want the output of this template to go to this project, and I want you to put it in this folder. it doesn't just automatically replace it. There's ways that you review it, you can merge it, you can update it. It takes a couple of minutes, and once you've changed your database, and everything just works. Any more questions before we close out?
You developed the result of CodeGen.
Yes, all CodeGen Hero does is output code you could have written by hand.
Right.
It's just that I don't like to write thousands and thousands of lines of code. My value as a pretty senior member at this point is not in writing all of that repetitive stuff. I'm going to make copy-paste errors. I'm going to get bored. I'm going to still have to build a client for my time. So instead, what we do is we'll do this, and then we're delivering the project, you know, much earlier than we otherwise would for specific applications. If you're building like a small Xamarin app, you got a few tables, or it's very graphics intensive, and it's not all about synchronizing data from the server to the client, this isn't the right solution. This isn't what you need. But if you have big databases, you have a lot of data, you don't want to write all those web API methods, you don't want to write all those mappers and everything else, then this is what you start with. And very quickly, we've been able to put out like proof of concepts, and very, very rapidly. We've been able to take people that were converting from, say, like Java or something, and they want to do .NET now. Well, here's an architecture for you. Have at it. And we just generate it. And then they start seeing the patterns, and they can learn from that. We really have only licensed it to our clients, to be honest. We've thought about productizing it, but we're kind of a small company, and I think you could understand it's sort of daunting to have to support something that's out in the wild like that. It would be cool to find a partner or something that was more in the product space that could help us get to that next level with it, because I think it has a lot of potential to add a lot of value for the community. The idea is it's all template-based. And it's not the only one. There's other tools out there, like CodeSmith has a tool, and there's other people, where you make templates, and the templates run against the metadata, et cetera.
Also, the new package.
Yes. So what she's saying is all the code that it relies upon is open source. Just the tool itself is not. Anybody else? Well, I hope that you guys had some interesting thoughts because of this. I hope that you get to use some of the sample code, some pieces of it, whether it's the authorization or the blobs or even the shell stuff, the data loading, which comes baked into the shell now with swapping out sample data or not. This is showing merging different files. It's not just going to overwrite it for you. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'm still here while I'm breaking down. If anybody wants to ask anything one-on-one, let me know.